Session number 3962, wheel number 2.
Colonel Ham, wheel 2. How were Africans recruited, Colonel?
The Africans, we had a system in the Gold Coast whereby your recruiters were ex-soldiers, most of them ex-sergeants or warrant officers, Africans. And part of their job was going around the tribes, because most of our recruits coming in were recruited from what we call the Northern Territories. We wouldn't take the coast boys.
Why was this?
Well, one of the reasons that they were a little bit not too good as a Northern Territory boy. We would rather have a boy who had no signs of life. I mean, where as a coast boy, probably mixed with all the cocoa boys and all the bits and pieces where the trading went on.
Are these the boys you call the savvy-savvy boys?
This is the savvy-savvy boy. This is the ones we didn't have, not till the war started anyhow. So most of your recruits all came from what we call the Northern Territories. And when they arrived, they were then put into houses and looked after. They had a very stiff medical. And then they were then put into the regimental depot, where they really had to start training and lots of PT, because you must remember these chaps came and they probably hadn't lived a life, a regular life, like they would do in a barracks. So
was recruitment popular? Did you ever have any trouble recruiting?
Now and again you've got the odd boy who wouldn't do whatever he was asked to do, but what normally happens was that when the boys arrived, you always had someone of their tribe in the regiment, so that you got their NCOs who could talk their language. This was another side to it, you see. And by virtue of putting the NCOs of that tribe, they would look after them and they would tell them exactly what was going to happen and this was going to happen and so forth. So the time that the chap came and joined the army, he knew exactly what he was in for.
And how long did they tend to join for?
7 years and 5 years reserve. There's 7 years with the colours and 5 years reserve.
What was their pattern of leave?
Their pattern of leave, after a year, they were allowed to go home. And the same with all the Africans. At the end of every 12 months, then the leave period came, and then they could go up to their own tribal areas, wherever they were going on leave.
For how long?
They had a month's leave. So it's the month's leave every year, you see, what they had it. But don't forget, the leave started when they arrived at the other end, and they reported to the district commissioner. That's when it started, the travelling time, because it's some of them travel great distances, you see, wherever they were going.
Is there a discernible career pattern? Few of them, of course, became NCOs and warrant officers.
Their career pattern, you could always pick out a good soldier at the end of his recruiting period, at the end of 6 months when he passed out the depot. Then you knew who your potential NCOs were going to be. And then, like all good things in the army, he's reported on by various people. So whoever changes over, and you also selected people to go into specialist jobs. I'm purely talking now about the infantry side, but don't forget, in the Gold Coast Regiment, we also had trained signals, and we had bandsmen, we had a band, we had drums, And the people who came to theirs, they were all trained at missionary schools. And to get into the signals, you had to pass what we used to call a Standard 7 missionary school, so that they spoke English and could write it. And those trained people came in as the signals, but don't forget the signals had to learn wireless and all that went with it. But the normal African who came from the Northern Territories, some of them were very good at picking odd things up, and so they were selected. Some was to go to machine guns, some would go to mortars and whatever jobs there were. And don't forget, a trained infantry man was the same. He had to fire his rifle or a boy's anti-tank, and he had to do all of that manoeuvres, and this is it, you see. It's
Did they have any formal education when they were in the army?
The education was done by the African NCOs. When you say education, I wouldn't put it down the same as the British Army, where everybody went to school. But they were taught by the African NCOs numbers and odd things that were going, you see. And eventually, we also taught them, this is where the pidgin English came in. And this, I suppose, being the formal English, they're passing out. They had to carry, they had to take a message, say 300 yards, bring a message back and take another message. And this is all done in pidgin English. And if an African could remember three messages like that, then he was really getting educated.
What about teaching numbers and mathematics?
No, I don't think so. No, but again, you see, the experience I had from a mortar training, when you had to train them to shoot, because you have to judge distances, and to tell an African to judge 1,500 yards is quite a long way, so you have to teach him.
How did you do this?
Well, if you look at the way of teaching anybody would be, say, an African is 6 foot high. Now, what does that chap look like at 300 yards? And when that normal range work, we used to shoot the rifle at 500 yards, 600 yards. So you could also teach him on the range. If you were shooting at 500 or 600 yards, and you would tell one of the butt markers to stand on the butt, and you could see how big he was. And by virtue of seeing his size, then you double that, you would get 1,200 yards. And this is one way of doing a field firing exercise, you see, is by teaching them to look at standard things and see how far they are away and what the heights are.
And when orders were given, these were presumably given as ordinary orders, like fire.
Always done in English.
In English.
Mm-hmm. Yes, all orders and instructions were given in English. This was another idea of teaching them pidgin English, you see, so that they could understand.
You said earlier the troops lived in lines, and you also said there was a man system. What exactly was this?
Well, the married lines, they all had their, it was a one long bungalow type, and each African had his own room, and the mammies, and then at the back of the room they had fireplaces where they cooked their meals. And from the mammy's point of view, in order to keep the lines clean, this was the mammy's job. And one of our jobs as in charge of them, we had to go around and see that the lines were cleaned every morning. And we used to have what we call a head mammy, and she wore around her neck a chain of office with a big brass plaque on it.
What's
A brass plaque.
What was she paid?
She was paid. She She was paid 5 shillings a month for being the head mammy, and she was in charge of all the women, and this was part of their job every day, was sweeping the lions and keeping them all generally clean. They were very good at it.
What happened to the children? Did they get any education?
The children, they were looked after, and also medical attention as well, and the wives were looked after medically. And the children, they used to go and have their own little classes, and they were taught by NCOs, and this was all part of the education that went on. And when the child got to a certain age, he could apply to go to a local government school, because these were situated all over the colony, girls' school and boys' schools. So if a child really wanted to learn, he could go to school and he'd be taught by African teachers.
Was this common?
Oh yes, very common. And they all, even on Empire Day, it was a great day for the school children, because wherever they were in the colonies, they all prayed with the district commissioner.
What date of the year was that?
This was the Empire Day, the 24th of May. Mm. And we had to pray as a regiment. We used to pray on Empire Day. And 3 cheers for Her Majesty, the king in those days, yeah, that's right, the queen.
What were the arrangements concerning the troops' food?
Troops' food, they looked after themselves. They were paid a subsistence allowance, and this is where the mammies came in. They looked after the single chaps as well in the lines. They all slept in the lines, so you had your lines wherever they were, and this was all part of it. And the mammies looked after the single chaps as well, and they came to their own arrangements of paying whatever they had to pay.
So the mammy might have a husband and family, but she might also take on...
Oh, yes.
...a number of single soldiers.
Single soldiers, and this came about, you see. It's, and it worked very well.
Mm. And did the troops get an extra allowance or a larger subsistence allowance if they had a larger family? Was it geared to a large family?
No. It's pretty hard to remember now about the pay side of it, but... they got paid a wage, and then they got, this included their subsistence as well, that's right. So a married chap wouldn't get what we call a marriage allowance, because don't forget, the troops were well paid. Whatever, I think it's about 3 shillings a day or whatever it was, something like that. And then as an NCOs and so forth, they got extra, you see, lance corporal, corporal sergeant, sergeant major. They all got paid extra.
Were they, do you think, much better paid than Africans employed, say, in European firms?
No. I would say this is all on a par. Mm. And depending on what job you were in, probably an educated African working for UAC would probably get a bigger wage, because he would be what we call a clerk status, you see, which is, and we in the regiment had our clerks as well, who worked in the company offices and the battalion audit rooms. This was all part of the thing, and they were, these chaps were really educated, the Africans, because they did all the pay lists as well, and this was their job, you see, typing.
And they were paid better than the
ordinary soldiers. Oh yes, yes.
You had servants, did you, during your stay in Africa?
We had servants. Each NCO, when you went out there, you were given what we call a boy, a house boy. And he looked after you, he did your washing, he kept your house clean, and really did everything, did your shopping for if you wanted shopping. But you also had an orderly in the regiment. And he cleaned all your equipment and stuff. That was his responsibility, whereas your houseboy looked after your house and your civilian side of it. So wherever you went, and when you went on manoeuvres or anything, your orderly looked after you. See, this is...
Now, were they reliable? Was he good?
Very good. Yes, the houseboys, no, they were first class.
Did you mix at all socially with your African NCOs?
Very little. We had odd parties. I remember one at the end of field firing. This was when we were down in camp in Accra. The last night in camp, all the Europeans, the officers and the BNCOs, we used to buy, you get palm toddy, and we used to buy this for the Africans. This was the last night at camp. And if they'd done well and fired well and did whatever they had to do, we bought the palm toddy. And we also had this campfire. And one of the amusing incidents that used to happen, each tribe had to dance a tribal dance around the campfire. And of course this made everybody laugh. And I remember one year the African Sergeant Major came over and said, why can't the Europeans doing their tribal dance? Well, you can imagine what the Europeans were like doing the tribal dance. And my company commander just looked at me and said, Han, he said, tribal dance. I said, what, the Lambeth Walk? And so you can imagine six Europeans going around the campfire doing the Lambeth Walk. And this, of course, this is the most amusing thing to the Africans, to think that we also had a tribal dance. By virtue of doing things like this, and I think this really endeared themselves to the Africans, and they thought more of the Europeans than anything at all. And I think this proved itself later on in wartime, when they were knew you, and if you led them into battle or you were with them, they had no fear, nothing at all. And this is all part of the training.
Did you find that you were at all interested in any African customs or
in the aspects of the Africans' way of life when you were there?
Oh, I think so, yes. Because after all, living cheek by jowl with the troops, you got to know a lot of their customs they had.
What sort of things?
They're very superstitious, you know, Africans. And I know on one occasion we lost a rifle out of the arms coat, because at the end of a day's training all rifles and everything had to be locked away under guard. But for some reason, I know, we missed a rifle. And in order to get to the bottom of this, which purely left it to the African Sergeant Major to try and sort it out. But somehow their fear, they fear it's what is locally known as juju. This is their fear, you see. So you bring in what they call a juju man. And this chap, he purely plays on the mind. This is their way of looking at it. And no Europeans are present whilst the chap is doing his job with the troops.
It's a sort of witch doctor, I think.
This is the same. It's the same sort of thing. See, but don't forget, when they live in bush, this is all part of their upbringing. And they bring in what they call the juju man. And so if ever you do find the chap, I suppose, we did never find the rifle. It just went for bush. I mean, that's that. But I don't think any of the African soldiers had it at all. It was purely lost, and that's that.
Was the juju man brought in very often?
No. No, it's all part. But there are superstition is very rife, even what it was before the war, right throughout West Africa. I remember we did a trip down to Lake Bosumtwi, which is a lake not very far from Kumasi, and this lake down there was known as the Juju Lake. And everything, even on the side of a road, you would suddenly come across the little idol of some kind, and you say to African, what is this? And he'd say, ah, he'd be Juju Man. And this is their way of doing it, you say.
Could you draw a distinction between this sort of superstition and what you might call religious practice? Or wasn't there anything that you could see as religious as we would understand it?
I think a lot of them were Muslims.
Oh.
This was their religion. But, I think as youngsters, when they're living with their tribes, if they did any wrong at all, this was always that someone would come out of the blue and do something to them. This is their way of putting a fear, I suppose, into a child to make it sort of go straight. And this is all part of their upbringing. So it's like in England, we have fairy tales, and they've got tales exactly the same, you see. And so wherever you meet, say, oh, I've got to tell them Juju Man that you've been doing them wrong. And this is the way they go on, you see. It's
did they have any Muslim observances in the camp? And did you take holy days off, for instance?
No. They were allowed to practice their own religions. And if they... I can't think of any local churches. We never had a church parade. Not from like we would in the British Army. I mean, this is it. We went to church, I mean, ourselves, because there was a church in Kumasi. I mean, so we went off on a Sunday. But no, I can't think of the Africans.
Were there any Christians amongst them?
Any?
Christians.
Oh, yes, there were Christians. Yes, they had Christians.
Did they go to the same churches?
Oh, yes, they would go to church, because you don't forget to see lots and lots of missionaries out there. And the conversion, they had lots of people, and people used to go to missionary schools. So, there's a lot of... And this proved itself during the war, because at odd times, wherever you were, we suddenly had a church parade, you know, right just in Africa. And the Africans would also come to this church as well. Just open-air church, and the padre would put a table up and a cross, and that was that. The Africans would still come, you see, and join in with us in the service.
What sort of an impact do you think the army made on the Africans who joined it?
I think you'll find that an African who'd been in the army, he'd learnt what I would call self-discipline to start with. And also it opened up quite an area for him with regards to employment. And don't forget there was always the police who would always take an army man, or they all the mines, the gold mines, the diamond mines in Africa, they all wanted guards. And so they would take on African soldiers as night watchmen. And it did open up, and they made first-class messengers. If you imagine the district commissioner with his office, he wanted a good chap to run messages or even to look after his office. These are the jobs that came for soldiers after they'd been in the army. And if a chap served long enough, he also got a pension, you see, at the end of 20 years, 21 years. So basically, even if he went back to his tribe, he had his memories to live on. And one particular instance that since the war, I attend the 24th Gold Coast Convention we have, and been going on now every year since the war. We just finished our 32nd. And our old doctor, Dr. Waddy, who's in the photograph, he got a job after leaving the Colonial Army with the World Health Organization. And this took him back to Africa, to the Northern Territories, where he specialized in what we call sleeping sickness. And on many of the occasions when he'd been attending our lunch, or we used to have dinners, we now have lunches, but he would come and tell us who he'd met and so forth. And on one particular occasion, he met the old African RSM, Basanga Gwuruchi, being looked after by his granddaughter. So these are the sort of things. But they, by virtue of being in the service, they learnt to look after themselves and also organise whatever they had to do.
I was told by another officer that medical facilities on the Gold Coast were very good, but this is because the health hazards were very high. Earlier in the tape, he didn't seem to indicate that this was the case. Was Africa a fairly healthy place for you at the time?
I think Africa as a whole, especially the West Coast, it was known as, don't forget, years ago, the white man's grave. And everybody who's going out there, you presume that this was your last journey on Earth, I suppose. But
really?
I think, basically, I said that we had a yellow fever and all the wherewithal. And in Kumasi, I know, we had an absolute first-class hospital. We had nursing sisters there, European nursing sisters, and the doctors at the facilities. And I think you'll find that I didn't go into hospital at all during my tour, I think. I suppose, again, it depends on the individual. It's like anywhere else. I mean, you get malaria in India, or just the same as one would do in West Africa.
Were the Africans themselves pretty healthy?
Yes, mostly. I think most of the Africans were very healthy. But again, there was a hospital, a regimental hospital, not being staffed by orderlies and looked after. No, I think we had the ordinary sickness. Don't forget, an African, they used to, when they lived in the tribal areas, their drinking water, they used to, was not clear, the same as ours would be if you're living in what we call a cantonment area. This would be looked after. You get the proper water coming from out of a tap. With an African, they're so used to drinking out of pools of water. And this is part of it, you see, where a tsetse fly breeds and all sorts of things breed in water. But this is the African, and they just drink out of a stream and wouldn't even think twice of putting a pill in the water to clear it or do whatever you want to do.
You think they were physically stronger by the time they'd done their service with the army?
I think so, because A, they were looked after, they were kept on the go, their physical condition was looked after, they had their PT